From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, water scarcity in Michigan? Believe it or not, it's happening.
We do sit in the center of the freshwater universe in Michigan, and to think that we could be water limited is almost a foreign concept to a lot of people.
She once worked in the Nixon White House, but today a former Republican economist is calling for a new political party.
If the polls are to be believed, a majority of Americans are as fed up as I am with the way the two current parties are behaving.
Giving a voice to the moderate majority. And we salute hard cider.
A lot of people in Michigan have a connection to hard cider. You know, since there's so much fruit grown here.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and a happy Thursday to all of you. Thanks for joining us. Great Lakes states average about a 30% rate of recycling. Michigan's recycling rate is somewhere around 14%. On today's program, why we're lagging when it comes to recycling. And then we speak with a former Nixon administration official who says the Republican Party has left her. So she has an idea. Create a new party, the moderate majority. But first, it's Thursday, so time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, who has been very, very busy digging up a story that could prove to have major impact on the futures of the Detroit Institute of Arts, Detroit's retired workers, and the city's bankruptcy proceedings. Daniel, all parties in this historic bankruptcy have been told, get creative, seek new solutions. What have you found?
Well, Chief Judge Gerald Rosen of the U.S. District of Eastern Michigan convened a meeting in his chambers last week with the heads of about 9 or 10 foundations, both national and regional and local, and essentially gave them a long briefing on what's going on in the bankruptcy, how complicated and complex it is. But near the end, he threw out an idea that is really very radical, and essentially it comes down to this. He's identified the DIA and the prospect of selling the art, and also the prospect of pensioners not getting a goodly chunk of the monies that they are owed under their agreements, to be the two big issues that could really mire the city's bankruptcy for years and years to come. And essentially what he did was suggest the possibility of creating a fund or backing a bond potentially that could be used to support pension payments and protect and pay essentially in lieu of the DIA. So the DIA wouldn't have to sell art. It wouldn't have to necessarily do anything that would disrupt its a tri-county millage that supports its operations.
Right.
And that this would protect the DIA that would potentially be conveyed over to either an authority or some kind of charitable trust that would ensure that this kind of thing never happened again should Detroit go back into bankruptcy at some point in the future. Initially, I'm told by people who were in the meeting, they kind of were like, are you out of your mind? And the longer that he talked and the longer he made the case based upon his legal assessment of what's likely to happen if one of those two things happen, mm-hmm. i.e. the pensioners were to sue and continue to push this thing all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, or conversely, if the DIA were to sue to stop any attempt to liquidate art, this thing would be stuck in litigation for many, many years. And essentially his argument came down to this: we need a clean slate, and this is maybe one way we can get there. Now, there's a lot of discussions that have to happen.
A lot of movable pieces in all of this.
Exactly. I mean, you know, they need more detail from the judge if, in fact, it's going to come forward. They need to go back to their staff people at the individual foundations and look at whether they think this is workable. They then have to decide whether they can pitch this to their boards of directors. I mean, there's a lot of gates that this would have to go through. Although unusual in this case, it would have to go through those gates fairly quickly compared to what these organizations are used to moving at.
So it started off, are you crazy? And then the longer he talked and the more they chewed it over, well, maybe there is something to this.
Well, I think it's really kind of – listen, you have to put this in context. I mean, as we all know, foundations – led by certainly like Kresge and Ford particularly are the two that come to mind, but there are others that I just named, have been supporting initiatives in the city of Detroit with greater urgency in the last, say, 5 years. So their boards have made investments in various aspects, whether it has to do with education or has to do with infrastructure, or it has to do with waterfront redevelopment or in the case of Kresge, the Detroit Future City effort. And I think part of the argument is if this thing gets mired and we can't get out of bankruptcy, and this is constant fight with pensioners and employees and all this negative publicity, this could not only hamper your investments as foundation investments in the city, it could also hamper other private sector reinvestment in the city, whether it's a Dan Gilbert or a potential outside investor from outside of Michigan who's looking to maybe take advantage of lower cost real estate and growth opportunities in Detroit or whatever the case may be. So his argument was really, this is a risk reward kind of analysis that we need to do, is the way I understand it. He did not put out a number saying we need X millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. He didn't do that. He talked about this conceptually. Now, there were people there who did talk about some numbers.
And what kind of numbers were they kicking around?
I've heard numbers from $300 million to $500 million, in some cases north of $500 million. And I think that's somewhat informed by a conversation that happened back in May with Ken Buckfire, the chief restructuring officer of the city from Miller Buckfire, and in a discussion with some DIA officials in which he suggested that could they pay the city $20 million a year over 30 years, essentially lease payments on the art, which would amount up to $600 million over 30 years. So bottom line is, we don't know, A, if this is going to happen, and B, how big or small these numbers are going to be, and I think they'd be more big than they'd be small. But I think it also underscores the fact that this bankruptcy is forcing dramatic change, and things that people had said would never happen before are now starting to happen. I mean, just yesterday, Kevin Orr confirmed something I'd already reported, which was that they were going to hire and let the private garbage collection contracts. So he's privatizing services. Belle Isle is now officially a state park.
Mm-hmm. So things are happening. It is interesting when you think about all these movable pieces and all these sides to this, but there seems to be a sense of, let's see if we can make this happen. Is there any sense of Kevin Orr's response to this?
Not directly, although I would say if you think about kind of what he's been saying publicly with increasing urgency about the DIA, for example, and urging them to get creative, urging them to come to the table, urging them to come up with some solutions, because I think the fear is once the evaluation of the art comes back from Christie, that those numbers are going to be potentially fairly large, and it makes a very difficult argument to make if the DIA basically says, we can't do this, and if you try to force us to do it, we're going to tie you up in litigation from now until kingdom come. And I think what you see happening here is a recognition that that is a threat. So essentially what the judge is, I think, thinking about is there a way to get other money that would, in essence, make the DIA's contribution for the DIA to some plan of settlement, and then protect the DIA in the process.
And get that nonprofit charitable trust set up, and then, therefore, everything's intact once the city emerges from bankruptcy and down the road.
Right, but I can certainly see, and I think we can all predict, that there will be some wailing about the fact that, you know, X billions of dollars of Detroit assets would all of a sudden be controlled by a nonprofit corporation or trust or whatever else. But the fact of the matter is that stuff would still be in Detroit, in the city, inside those four walls on Woodward Avenue.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, his piece today in the Detroit News, donors are pitched to ADIA and pensions. Thanks so much for talking with us, as always.
Thank you.
Michigan's Secretary of State is proposing an end to secretly funded political ads. Republican Ruth Johnson proposed a new rule today requiring sponsors of so-called issue ads to file reports with the state and meet current campaign finance requirements. Now, currently, only ads urging voters to support or oppose a specific candidate are subject to disclosure requirements. Issue ads, now those are the ones that define a candidate's suitability for office without directly urging a yes or no vote, those are exempt. Joining us now is Chris Gouts, Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Chris, what's behind these new proposals from the Secretary of State?
Well, I think it's because they've become so prevalent. We've seen so much of this in the last few years. And what really caused this action to take place by the Secretary is that a few months ago, there was a request that these issue ads be disclosed just for judicial candidates. And so she was waiting to decide how she was going to rule on that. And she declined to carve out especially just the issue ads for judicial candidates. And and really opened the door completely and said, we're not going to do it for them. But she went a step further and said, we're going to do it for everyone now. And that really took a lot of people by surprise today when she announced that.
So who do we expect to be unhappy with these new rules?
Well, it didn't take long at all. Within a matter of hours, the Senate Republicans were debating a bill earlier today regarding campaign finance, and they tacked on an amendment that basically squashes what Secretary Johnson was trying to do. So I don't know where her proposal is going to go now, because they clearly have shown where they stand on this issue by just not even letting it, you know, breathe. I mean, it was less than 2 hours that went by, and then they added this amendment that said, you know, forget it. We're not going to go that route.
And they passed that bill, so that would block it, as you say, squashes it flat before it even has a chance to say hello to everybody.
Well, this bill will now go to the House, and we'll see what they do with it. But interestingly enough, when we were talking with Secretary Johnson this morning, she did say that she talked with Governor Snyder last night about this bill or about this rule, and he was supportive of it. So this is going to get to his desk. So we'll see what he does with this. Would he veto it because of this amendment? I guess we'll have to see.
So what's the timeline on all of this?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, we asked, you know, could this apply to, you know, the 2014 race, you know,
right,
for governor, or, you know, the Senate race with Gary Peters running against, you know, presumably Terry Lalonde, obviously a former Secretary of State who's had this question posed to her before.
Sure.
About this ruling. And it sounds like it probably wouldn't apply, because when you're changing a rule like this, the idea is that you should go slow so that you can hear all of the, you know, arguments for and against, and make sure that you're not doing anything that's really going to screw things up, have some sort of unintended consequence. And so we were told that these type of rule changes can take anywhere from 12 to 15 months before they are actually implemented. So we might not have actually seen any change in this election, but now it sounds like we might not see any anyway.
Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, keeping an eye on things in Lansing for us. As always, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So you have fished out the last pickle from the pickle jar. Now what? Do you rinse it out and tote it out to your recycling bin to be hauled out to the curb alongside your garbage can on trash pickup day? Do you bring it to a recycling center? Or do you just toss it in the trash? The answer, it seems, for a lot of Michigan households and businesses seems to be toss it in the trash. Michigan's recycling rate is somewhere around a paltry 14.5%, way below other Great Lakes states, averaging a 30% recycling rate. Governor Snyder has pinpointed recycling as a top priority issue, and the Department of Environmental Quality is trying to come up with a proposal to expand recycling in Michigan. But we still have a long way to go.
If we could accomplish our 50% recycling goal, the value of that material, if diverted from the landfill, is about $500 million a year.
That's Karen O'Brien, the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. And she says when we don't recycle, that means Michigan's losing out on those millions of dollars when we could be selling recycled materials to companies that buy the materials to make new products. Also joining this conversation is Barry Rabe. He's a professor of environmental policy at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Welcome back to Stateside, Barry.
Thank you, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Barry Rabe, some of the biggest cities in Michigan, Sterling Heights comes to mind, don't even have curbside recycling. Why is it taking such a long time to get the programs right into the cities?
I think it's safe to say that at least one factor is the fact that local governments in Michigan, as well as the state, have lost a lot of funding, have lost staffing positions. And when you weigh all of the priorities that are facing a current mayor, whether or not they're under an emergency manager regime, as in Detroit and other places, you know, I'm not sure that recycling comes to the very top of the list. You know, when Mike Duggan was elected mayor of Detroit last week, he has his priorities: police, fire,
streetlights,
schools,
yeah,
funding, streetlights. Recycling is hugely important, but for a lot of jurisdictions, it's probably easy to kind of kick that proverbial can figuratively and literally down the road and not really worry too much about it unless there's something that brings recycling to your more immediate attention.
Barry, when you look at policy regarding trash and landfills and recycling around the world, are there approaches that are working better in other countries that we might want to look at as policy here? And the reason I ask that is I just know from going to and from Ireland, we have to take our trash in to a center. You pay by the pound to get rid of it. And so, boy, there's a real incentive for pitching those bottles into the – we break them down by color. We, you know, the plastic milk jugs go in their own thing. So we do the work. But the penalty for not is a really stiff price to get rid of your trash.
And I think a couple of the key phrases are you pay by the pound and face stiff penalties.
Yeah.
Ironically, this is a state – that took early and historic action as far back as 1978, putting a deposit on beverage containers.
Right.
Huge impact, hugely successful. Since that time, and 1978 is a long time, I think there has been a greater reluctance in this state to impose a fee or impose a cost. That can take many, many forms, and Karen's organization has done some really fine work looking at what some of the options are. But whether it's revisiting the container deposit system, different fees and other kinds of mechanisms. I think all of those are potentially on the table, but I would argue that one sees, whether it's member states of the European Union, some of the provinces of Canada, even other states that have been much more effective than Michigan has in recent years or decades, there has been a willingness to impose some kind of a cost, but then with it make very clear to the public what the benefit is. Increased recycling opportunities, economic benefits, the full package, that linkage of imposing a cost and a benefit is a challenge, but I think also an opportunity in Michigan.
And we know you actually had a recent column in the Free Press, Karen, kind of exploring what's happening with this proposal that's trying to come together with the Department of Environmental Quality to expand recycling. And it's being hung up, you pointed out, on the bottle bill.
You know, the bottle bill opponents have, you know, and those are retail stores that really bear the burden of managing bottles and cans. You know, they have been at the table for a very long time, wanting us to recognize the burden to them for managing these materials. And, you know, I pointed out in that article that really these bottles and cans only make up 2 to 3% of our waste stream. So, you know, as Barry pointed out very correctly, the impact is huge on, you know, keeping our streets clean and reducing the litter impacts of these, you know, materials. But it's probably lulled us into a false sense of recycling. So we are trying to get to, you know, a much greater percent of material recovery, and it's going to take infrastructure that goes far beyond what retail stores can do, you know, with bottles and cans. But they're at the table, and they're concerned with, you know, how we're going to move forward. There's been a lot of discussion about expanding the bottle bill. There's been a lot of discussion about, you know, what if we take the bottle bill away? What does that do for us? But my point is, you know, let's talk about real recycling and providing comprehensive services throughout the state to residents, to businesses, so that we can capture the most material we can. And we won't get to that discussion until we kind of put this bottle bill discussion behind us.
Barry, when you think of, as you pointed out, the lost dollars and the lost staffing that municipalities have dealt with and counties, is there the political will or muscle there to tackle this recycling issue?
Well, I think we are beginning to see local governments, for the most part in Michigan, beginning to feel some degree of post-recession stabilization to occur. That said, most are not quickly going back to staffing levels and being able to expand, so there really is that issue in question. I think the moment is ripe for a serious conversation in local communities in Lansing for how different fees, charges, taxes, whatever you want to call them, might be established and put in place. I think it intriguing as we move into this period of the Snyder administration, which has aggressively emphasized issues like best practice, making Michigan a national leader on a number of issues, and being very transparent about performance. The one indicator or measure that you see on the Michigan dashboard on recycling is just the number of counties that have convenient access to recycling. And the Snyder administration has argued we have moderate success because a couple more counties have entered into that list. You know, hopefully we go beyond that, and that means, you know, cracking the tough nut of where revenues are going to be derived, how they're going to be derived, and how you build support. And really, is there public support beyond, you know, public opinion surveys at the real level for people to make behavioral changes?
And that's where the Michigan Recycling Coalition is trying to do that heavy lift. Karen, is what does it take to get the public to buy into the importance of this?
Well, first and foremost, it takes, you know, convenient recycling options. And, you know, we have the southern parts of Michigan are fairly well served, but one of the largest cities in Michigan is not yet well served. And so we're really struggling to provide the infrastructure we need to provide so that citizens can participate. And then it's a matter of, you know, norming recycling, helping people make the transition between thinking about things as waste and invaluable to thinking about things as valuable and putting them in the right place. And so it does. It takes a behavior change to do that. But I think we're going to find, you know, increasing efforts to control the waste stream. And we saw that last week in this effort to provide exemptions to the yard waste ban for landfills. These efforts to use, you know, these materials more productively are very important for Michigan as we move forward. And I think the people of Michigan believe this, and there are many that participate in recycling programs at a very high level. We just haven't been good as a state at providing the leadership and helping Michiganders identify themselves as, you know, the environmentalists and the recyclers we all really are at heart, because we live in such a beautiful state.
That was Karen O'Brien. She's the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Karen joined us from Lansing. And Barry Rabe, professor of environmental policy at U of M, where he directs the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Thank you so much for a great conversation and giving us a lot to think about.
Thanks very much.
And now, from recycling to preserving Michigan's favorite natural resource, water. Michigan is surrounded by 20% of all surface freshwater on Earth. That's 6 quadrillion gallons. Wrap your mind around that for a moment. And then ask yourself this: why do we have a growing number of homeowners, farmers, and businesses in Michigan facing water scarcity issues? Contributing writer Jeff Alexander looked at this question in a recent piece for Bridge Magazine entitled "Water, Water Everywhere in Michigan, But Is It Enough?" Welcome back to Stateside, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
It seems mind-boggling to think that there are people living on Lake Michigan, for instance, who are having a problem with their groundwater. What's going on here?
Well, it's important to separate the Great Lakes for a moment from groundwater resources. And so in Ottawa County, which is on Lake Michigan, in the eastern part of the county, which is reliant on groundwater for drinking water, they were pumping so much water out of the ground that they were getting down into salt water or brine, which sort of sits at the bottom of the aquifer under the good water, the usable water.
Mm-hmm.
So it started to show up in these two large new subdivisions where, you know, people were getting brine in their tap water, and the county discovered that they're just pumping too much water out of the ground. And so it was affecting some new subdivisions, some farmers, and it was a huge surprise to everyone.
So what are we talking about when we hear that term groundwater withdrawals? What is it, and what are the biggest causes of it?
Well, the best way to think about groundwater is that, you know, Michigan is sort of like a giant sponge. I mean, we sit on this large layer of groundwater. So if you think of there being sort of a sponge under the ground that contains this, you know, vast amount of fresh water,
mm-hmm.
that's groundwater in sort of a very crude sense.
Right.
So individuals and businesses and industries will put wells into this groundwater and draw from it. And there's a phenomenal amount of groundwater beneath Michigan, but not all of it is usable. Some of it is brine. And so, you know, brine really doesn't have much use in terms of drinking water or using for, you know, manufacturing purposes or anything like that. So the amount of usable groundwater in Michigan is finite. It's not an unlimited resource.
And what are some of the main reasons? I've got to imagine farm irrigation is a big one.
Yeah, if you look at total water use in Michigan. You know, the largest users of water in the state are power plants that, you know, they just use phenomenal amounts of water to generate electricity. But if you look at actual consumption of water in terms of, you know, who's using the water and in the sense that it's gone for good, the largest use is irrigation for farms, golf courses, lawns.
Is fracking playing a role in this?
Fracking is a large use of water in Michigan and becoming a larger use. A single well in a fracking operation can use, you know, upwards of 10 million gallons of water. And most of that water is gone for good because they put chemicals and sand into it.
Right.
And when they use it, they leave most of it underground.
Now, you have a map in your piece in Bridge that kind of shows where recent large-scale water withdrawals have been going on in Michigan, and it certainly seems like Southwest Michigan is doing a lot of that.
Yeah, groundwater demand has really increased dramatically in Southwest Michigan because of the increased demand for corn, for ethanol.
Mm.
So a lot of these farms are ramping up production. They're, you know, they're growing more corn. Corn is a very, you know, water-dependent crop. And so the problem in Southwest Michigan is that these farmers are sort of running up against this state law that limits how much groundwater can be pumped out of the ground. The state is saying, you know, we need to slow down and not move so quickly that, you know, we sort of go beyond the point of no return where we don't have enough groundwater. The farmers are saying that they just don't think that, they think the state law is too restrictive.
I'm speaking with Jeff Alexander, contributing writer for Bridge Magazine. His piece on water scarcity in areas of Michigan is called Water, Water Everywhere in Michigan, But Is It Enough? In a recent issue of Bridge Magazine. What are people saying, Jeff, as this is happening? People opening up a tap and getting water that's cloudy or discolored or has brine in it. That has to be extremely agitating.
Well, people are agitated, and I think they're just sort of shocked because, you know, we do sit in the center of the freshwater universe in Michigan, and to think that, you know, we could be water limited is almost a foreign concept, I think, to a lot of people. You know, one of the reasons we did the article was just to sort of get this issue on people's radar that, you know, water is a finite resource, even in Michigan. And, you know, that's sort of, you know, like they say, education is the first step toward enlightenment or change. So that's the first thing, is to just let people know that, you know, this is a finite resource. There are pockets of the state that are having, you know, pretty serious issues with, you know, limits on water use.
So it seems a shift in mindset is very much needed for everyone in Michigan, who, of course, we've all grown up being told we are the water wonderland.
We are the water land, and I think that, you know, puts a greater responsibility on us to take care of water. You know, water is being called the oil of the 21st century, and, you know, with this global economy, you know, there's more people in the world, there's greater demand for food, and some of these other parts of the world that don't have water for food, they're going to look to water-rich areas like us. And we do limit how much water can be taken out of the Great Lakes. That's pretty well protected. But, you know, I think we could all do our part to reduce our water use. And, you know, it's not hard to do. It's just something you have to think about. And, you know, sometimes I tell people, you know, if you want to think about why we should reduce our water use, if you're not altruistic, just think of water as money. And, you know, when you're letting water just, you know, run down the drain while you're brushing your teeth or you're taking an extra long shower, you know, you're just wasting money.
Jeff Alexander looked at water scarcity in parts of Michigan. His recent piece for Bridge Magazine, it is entitled Water, Water Everywhere in Michigan, But Is It Enough? And Jeff Alexander joined us from Grand Haven. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, We speak with a former Nixon administration official who says the Republican Party in 2013 has left her. But not to worry, she's got a plan, the creation of a new party, the moderate majority. We find out more next. And then cider, make that hard cider. Sales are on the rise. We talk to a cider maker in northern Michigan in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Well, if all this talk about politics makes you want to reach out for a drink, think cider. Nope, not that delicious cider we enjoy with the hot donuts at the cider mill. This is the stuff you have to be over 21 to buy. Hard cider. It's much beloved in pubs in Britain, Ireland, and parts of Europe. And now we Yanks are discovering it here. 20 years ago, virtually no one in the States bought hard cider. This year, sales are expected to hit $172 million. Michigan cider producers Dan Young and his wife Nikki own Tandem Ciders in northern Michigan. And Dan tells me it was a trip to England that inspired them to take up cider making.
We saw the apples growing. The growers delivered the apples to the local cider maker, and then it was pressed and fermented and served right there. So it was a really neat connection to the land of southern England. And when we moved up to Sutton's Bay in 2004, my wife and I were just struck by that same, you know, just the fruit that's grown here. I mean, if you've ever visited Leelanau County, it's amazing the number of cherries and apples and grapes that are grown up here.
I know what Dan's talking about. I've been going back and forth to Ireland since 1973, and it was very early on I discovered Bulmer's hard cider made in Clonmel County, Tipperary, and loved it. Dan and Nikki of Tandem Ciders put those roots down in the Leelanau Peninsula and started turning out hard cider. So, Dan, it didn't take too much to get you two to decide you were going to go from drinking cider to actually making it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I had been a brewer for at least 12 years before that. And when we moved up here, I was thinking of starting another brewery. I was like, oh, you know, I wanted to do a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then suddenly it's, no, cider makes so much sense. And there were a few other factors, too. When we first moved to Michigan, I was introduced to these people. It was called the Michigan Hard Cider Initiative. And it was the Michigan State University and Michigan Apple Committee joined up to start this hard cider initiative. And they were trying to encourage people to go into the hard cider business as a way to use up, at the time, was this excess apple crop in Michigan. So it just made sense. It just kind of connected. And the other thing about hard cider is I think a lot of people think of, you know, it's kind of linked to beer in some ways.
Right.
But the way it's produced is often much more like wine. So up here in Leelanau County, there's a number of wineries that have opened, and it's a nice wine community. So opening a hard cidery just kind of made sense and kind of fit into what was going on up here already.
So you get customers coming in to find, you know, get their first experience with hard cider. Did it take a lot of explaining to get them to understand what it was they were drinking?
It's interesting. There's a lot of people in Michigan have a connection to hard cider. You know, since there's so much fruit grown here, you always hear stories of, oh, you know, my uncle had a barrel in the back shed, and my grandpa had a couple of barrels in the basement. So I think a lot of people already have this connection to hard cider. So there are those that were, you know, looking for it to, you know, reconnect. And then just people had never heard of it before. And there was a little explaining. Certainly when we opened in 2008, we had people coming in, you know, especially off the wine trail. And they'd say, hey, what do you make that's red? And I'm like, oh, it's Tandem Ciders. But, you know, certainly now there's a lot less of that. And there's a lot more people I find as, you know, you hear a lot more people trying to go gluten-free in their lives or minimize the amount of gluten. And cider is a good way to experience, you know, like a pint of something without the gluten.
And the apple growers have to love this.
Yeah, it's been really great. You know, it's a great way to use up excess apples. And I think a lot of guys are starting to plant cider-specific apples for us. So it's really nice. There's a grower we're working with who's going to put in 1,500 trees of apples that were specifically grown for hard cider. So that's we're pretty excited about that. I think that's going to be the big change in the Michigan cider scene in the next dozen, 10 years or so, is just these return to these cider-specific varieties.
it really hit me as I looked at your website. You list 11 different ciders, so it is very much like a winery in the terms of the kinds of products you can get with different types of apples.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, Michigan's a great place for that because, you know, I think we're the third largest grower of apples in the country, but we have the most diverse apple crop. So we have more varieties grown here than there are in other states. And I think that gives us, you know, there's, I think, 20 of us now making hard cider in Michigan. So, the, you know, this great variety of apples that we have here is just fantastic.
You know, we hear from the craft brewers that Michigan's beer-producing community is pretty supportive of each other. Are the 20 cideries the same way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we all feel like, you know, the more the merrier at this point. We have customers that come in who are from, like, the Grand Rapids area. I'll say, hey, you know, there's Vander Mills down in Spring Lake by you guys, and, you know, people by Lansing, this Uncle John Cidery makes some great cider there. So, you know, it's good to just to have that community.
Dan Young owns Tandem Ciders in Sutton's Bay, and you can learn more at their website, tandemciders.com. I look forward to coming to visit and sample some of those 11 ciders you have at Tandem. Thank you so much, Dan.
Yep, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Have you discovered the joys of hard cider? Have you got a favorite Michigan cidery? Or, for that matter, a favorite winery? We always love talking about cider, wine, and craft beer on Stateside. Reach out to us and let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, you can find us at michiganradio.org and just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Katie Suha, Clara Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.